We have a couple of great questions for Ask Catherine, but of course they're precious metals questions. So I'm going to defer them for our conversation with Franklin. We've had a lot of activity in the precious metals market over the last month, so we have a lot to talk about. And I can tell you I'm over at Franklin's abode this evening, and it's wonderful to be back in Tennessee, and it's wonderful to be back, Franklin, with you and Susan.
Well, thank you.
So tell us, catch us up on the markets. Tell us about the last month.
Well, the last month has been painful in the extreme. You know, as the month has gone on, it's become more and more evident that the Eurozone did nothing more with Greece than paper over their problems, because now Spain is in trouble. This week, the fourth largest bank in Spain went down. The Spanish government announced they'd spend $13.8 billion, 10 billion euros to or $13 billion, 10 billion euros to bail them out. And it just gets worse and worse. And what's happening is that fear is driving people into safety, into what they think is safety. And it gives you a real picture of what an insane world we live in, that those investors think that U.S. government debt, U.S. government treasuries mean safety. But that's, you know, that's what the perception is, and that's the place that they go. So that has sucked money out of stocks. That's sucked money out of the silver and gold markets. And so it's, you know, we've had the last 10 days have been just almost unrelenting declines. The euro, the dollar has advanced. The euro has dropped. And the dollar really, I think, is key for a while to the situation, because the perception, not the reality, but the perception is that there's not going to be any more gross inflation like QE1 and QE2, although you and I both know, and by now all of your listeners know, that that's a joke, that they have to continue to inflate. But the dollar went down, and it made a double bottom with the April low, and it's been in a trading range, but And in that trading range, it's formed an even-sided triangle, and this week it broke out to the upside of that triangle. So what you have to look at is that the dollar could rally to from 80, where it is now, all the way up to 89. And
you think it could go that high?
Well, let me talk about what the things that are against it. From a technical standpoint, yes, it could go that high, but it's by no means certain yet that it actually will go on and move on up. And there are political factors that militate against that. And one of those political factors is this is an election year.
Right.
And the way things are working right now, if the dollar goes up, U.S. stocks go down. That's just, you know, that's been the mood of the market. That's the way it trades right now. And so if the Fed, which generally is known to accommodate the sitting president with monetary conditions that will help him be reelected, and that's, you know, they do that for Republicans or Democrats now. Why, I don't know, but apparently they do. So if they try to accommodate him with a lower dollar, then they might be able to manipulate stocks higher. But how much lower can they let the dollar go? If it breaks 70, roughly 76.5, then you're looking at 70 and all kinds of other problems.
Right.
On the other hand, if they let it go up, you're looking at the S&P at 500 at 1,000, and the dollar index at 89, and the economy in complete shreds, because at that rate, U.S. exporters will find it much harder to export. And so you put pressure on U.S. manufacturers, and everybody in the world is trying to depreciate his own currency protectively against everybody else to protect their share of the export market. So it's not clear which way the dollar is going to go. Let's just say that it is right now at a crossroads, and if it can get up above, say, 82.5, then the likelihood is very much increased that it's going to go, oh, you know, to 88, 89, something like that. And that, of course, puts a headwind up against gold and silver, but that's not really such a surprising thing, because gold and silver, after a big rise like they've had, can take as much as a year and a half to recover. And by recover, I don't mean simply that they come up off a bottom. I mean that they go to a level higher than the last peak before the contraction or the correction started. So the last peak was at 1927 on an intraday basis back in August or September. And so you're looking at the amount of time that it takes to correct from that high until it gets to a level higher than 1927. So that could very well be a year, 18 months, which even at a year brings you to the fall, and that would be, that would kind of work out with a 6 month advance in the dollar. I think that gold and silver though have probably put in their lows for this move.
And, well, I think you're an optimist.
Well, I may be. I may be. And gold may go down to 15.25, and silver may go down to 27.5. That certainly is a possibility. But you're going to see that before the end of May. You're probably going to see it before the middle of May expires. The action in the market I described today to you when we were having supper was very, very positive. And both silver and gold, as well as the stock markets, have put in on the five-day chart a kind of an upside-down head and shoulders, which often is a reversal formation. So it's not necessarily a reversal formation. Sometimes it's just a continuation, but often it's a reversal formation. So we ought to get a little rally here anyway. Looking at a longer-term chart, both silver and gold have this falling wedge, which is what normally is a bullish formation. That is, it normally resolves by breaking out to the upside. Both of them have moved to the lower boundary of that formation, and almost to the point of it. So they're either going to go a good bit lower than where they are now, say 2% or so, or they're going to turn around from right here. And I have no way of telling which they're going to do. I mean, I just say that it looks very, very, they look very, very positive today. The RSI for gold is way down at the low range where it normally starts turning up again. And other indicators, some that I look at for silver especially, indicate that silver is very, very close to a bottom. So even if you get a bottom, though, the thing to remember is that we're still laboring through this correction, and so whatever advance gold and silver make from here probably will not be sudden, unless, of course, the euro falls apart or European banks fall apart, there's another crisis that breaks out in Europe, and then you can't really tell what will happen because you don't know where the fear will send those people looking
right
for safety. You know, they might go to dollars. You presume they'll go to dollars, but they might go to gold too.
Well, you know, I've seen more than a few reports, including from people I know, that Europe refiners are busy as all get out.
Yes.
But that's not what we're seeing here. We're not seeing a lot of activity in the physical market.
Oh gosh, it's been the deadest. It's been the deadest that I can remember it. Almost in the last month has been one of the deadest periods in the last 10 years. And when I say dead, I mean the phone does not ring. It's very, very, it's been very, very unusual. And yet this week, we had a long flat market. We had a long period when markets stayed at roughly the same level in the same range. And it always happens that when markets don't go anywhere, that nobody is changing his mind. When you get a break like we've had in the last week to new lows, then all of a sudden the buyers come out of the woodwork. And so that's what we've seen, whereas last week and the week before, I'd go over to the wall and unplug the phone and then plug it back in to make sure it was still operating, call the repair service and see if our phone is working. But now this week it's just been incredibly busy. So all that was necessary was to get to a level where those people who were waiting to buy were convinced that this is the time to do it. And
I wanted to mention my notion of the gross revenue pledge.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on Wall Street, the New York City subway and bus system was needed to make a significant capital investment, and 9 investment banks told them that they'd never be able to sell bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And our company decided that they could. They told them they could, so we got the assignment. And so the guy who got the assignment for us came in and he said, look, they've got 4 bonds they have to do. One's a no-brainer, so if we fail on the other 3, we get the 1. So I figured it was worth saying we could do it. So since you're a new young VP, you get the 3 done, and when it fails, you'll take the blame, and then I can do the other bond. So, but it turned out we did get the 3 done. It was a huge, it was the only time an investment-grade rating got a front-page New York Times story. And but the way we did it was as follows. When you go into the subway system in New York, you put your money, now it's a card, but in those days you put your money into the booth, and that all that change would get sucked up, and no bank could take, you know, no bank was set up to handle that volume of change, so the money would go over to the Federal Reserve. And the first thing that would happen is the debt service would get taken out there before it went into the Transit Authority bank account, and it was called a gross revenue pledge. And to a certain extent, my feeling is that gold has a gross revenue pledge on the derivatives. If you look at the derivatives position, so I just mentioned the derivatives infographic that I linked mm-hmm. to up in Money and Markets on the blog, because it just shows you why there is this constant sucking sound up to the banks of, you know, of every sort of available ounce of free cash is getting sucked up to support that leverage in the banking system. And my feeling is, as long as the banks command that sucking sound, then that cash, by definition, which is debasing, has to then drive gold up. And it's almost like gold has a gross revenue pledge on the derivative cash flows.
Well, you know, just to buttress what you're saying, one of the problems for people who live in the U.S. is they don't really know yet how bad things can get and how quickly they can go bad. I have an acquaintance in Greece, who real clever fella. I mean, he's really, really bright. And I've been corresponding with him about the Greek situation. And he can give you so many reasons to buy gold that I keep thinking maybe he ought to be writing my daily commentary instead of me. But the fact is, I mean, he has experienced the sharp edge of bank failure, bank insolvency, and governments acting to save the banks. And he understands that the only thing that would do the Greeks any good and the Greek government is to just declare bankruptcy and
start again.
And do it again. Yeah, start again and learn to live within your means,
right,
which they're not going to do until they're, of course, forced to it. But the point is, he has no doubt. He's not worried about gold being, you know, gold going down. He doesn't have that problem. And so he has the big picture. And the big picture, really, Catherine, is what all of us need to grab. I'm not dexterous enough. I'm sure there are people who think about it all the time and stay up night studying it who can pick tops and bottoms in markets, but most people can't do that. And not even the experts that I follow can do it with enough consistency to make me want to do it. So you have to look at the big picture and say, okay, where is the world going and how do I train? And the fact is that the central banks were created as a tool for the banks to try and keep the banks solvent and to give the banks control of the economy, and they're going to continue to print money to help those banks. I mean, it's just, there's no question about it. So given that reality, you can't argue about the primary trend. In addition, from a technical standpoint, you can look at the peaks that we had in silver and the peak we had in gold back in August, And you compare those to 1980, and it becomes very evident. It becomes evident immediately. Those are not comparable moves. So we haven't seen that blow off top. And I continue to say, we've made it maybe a third of the way in terms of price through the gold bull market.
Okay, so let me take the opposite position, because one of my favorite expressions, my ceiling partner, Chuck Gibson, I was always saying, what if we're wrong? What if we're wrong? What if we're wrong? So we always try to come up with the scenarios of what if we're wrong. And here's what I think. If you look at the things that could tip the global economy into a serious deflation, and in a serious deflation, gold and silver are still invaluable things to have, but their price in dollars is going to go down. Or their price in whatever fiat currency is backed up by the most, you know, the best military and the most force.
Mm-hmm.
So in that scenario, I don't see a way of managing deflation without war. In other words, when you get into that scenario, your problem is not that your gold and silver is down. The problem is there's a thermonuclear device going off, you know, down the road. So here's the question. Is there a way you can foresee a serious long-term deflation, and is there a way you can foresee it without war?
Well, the answer to that second question is no, I can't foresee it without war. And I think, and one of the things that you need to remember is that periods of economic cooperation, harmony, and prosperity are generally followed by the opposite. About 1911, 1913, international trade and the U.S. participation in international trade peaked, and it didn't come back to that until recently. It didn't come back to those levels until recently. Well, what happened after 1911, 1913? World War One,
right?
And then World War Two. So you had a period of 30 years war, and of course it didn't start with a deflationary trend. It started with stability and economic harmony, but it certainly, you know, it set up the world for this enormous burst of inflation. You know, the German currency was ruined, the French currency was ruined, the dollar was severely damaged, the pound was ruined, everybody in the world went off the gold standard, and so forth. So I think, you know, this is the thing that I found it hard to communicate, that I find hard to communicate to people, is the nature of a system. Inflation is to the present monetary, governmental, and financial system the same way oxygen is to your body. Your body can't live without oxygen. So if you begin to be starved for oxygen, you're going to start gasping for air.
Right.
And the same way, they can't live without inflation. And so if their body threatens to go into deflation, that is to be without oxygen, they will inflate.
Right. And another way to think about it is if I can't print money to hand out as pet treat and bribes, I can't stay in control.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I've always believed, because I think part of this, you know, the way I look at things is geopolitically, I've always believed that gold and silver, gold in particular, was essential to shifting out of the old model and into the new model.
Mm-hmm.
And the people leading this see gold as a very important sort of metacurrency to engineer that. So I've always believed that they wanted a managed rise. What they don't want is they don't want a rise that's going up too fast vis-a-vis stocks and bonds so that those markets unravel. They're trying to keep it in balance.
Right.
And what's very interesting, there have been a couple of polls that have absolutely floored me. I put them both up on the blog. But one was, I forget when it was, a couple months ago, showing that 34% of Americans said that gold was the best investment, way ahead of the stock market.
What?
Way ahead of it. No, it was unbelievable. It was on all the mainstream press. And you could, you know, I was floored. And then a new Gallup poll has come out, and it shows that gold is down from 34 to 28. And I said, well, you know, it's working. The strategy that of keeping the price down is working, because they're getting it more in line with the stock market. Remember, if your goal is to keep corporate cost of capital at rock bottom relative to governments. You know, that's what you've got to do. So to me, I've always believed that this was going to be, you know, I think we might get a short-term rally, but I always thought this was going to be a very, very rough summer for gold. And because if you look at the politics, they need to keep this under tight wraps, particularly coming into the election. They need to get that 28, you know, down much closer to the stock market is what I believe.
Well, but let me just bring up another little technical point that seasonally the gold market often bottoms in May. You get highs, you often get highs in the first part of the year, but there's a kind of alternation that sometimes puts lows in May as well. So, you know, it seasonally we're entering into a time for a low right along here. Anytime we could see a low, and then that market could go, then gold and silver could go basically flat to a little higher over the summer and begin, then resume their seasonal pattern where they start rising in late August or September and rise into the end of the year. So
it's funny, I'm on an email list with a group, and including Jim Sinclair, so I wrote that I thought this summer was going to be, you know, was somebody was saying it was going to take off. And they have to, you know, once Operation Twist is up in June 30, there's every reason to believe in an election year that they're going to pump some more. So I could understand why they would argue that. And so I jumped in and I said, it's going to be a long, slight, long hot summer. And Jim Sinclair wrote back and said, good luck on your shorts. I said, I'm not short. I'm long and holding. Anyway, so well, any other... you know, I'm looking down the pike to next year, Franklin, and whether it's the tax rates or interest rates, there's so much potential for bad news that I think, you know, all investors are looking at all their holdings across the board and saying, you know, is anything safe? You know, and I think that's part of the psychology that we're all dealing with.
Are you asking me if anything is safe?
I don't know why. Every time we start talking about this, I think of you telling me I needed to buy extra brooms, because there are times when you can't trade gold and silver, but you can trade brooms. Anyway, so we've got a couple of great questions. Let me just put some of them to you.
Mm-hmm.
One is, how is TPP going to affect farmers in this country? I've noticed palladium has been holding fairly steady compared to other metals. What's TPP?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
PTT or TPP?
TPP.
I don't know. Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Another question of the impact of the CME margin requirements on price.
Mm-hmm. Well, they raised them again. They raise them, they lower them, and they raise the speculative margins. And that.
What day did they raise them?
The day we got a $19 drop.
Right.
And that, you know, that's something that you... That's something frequently seen, I think, when the establishment, a.k.a. the Federal Reserve, wants to drive down the price of gold, they raise those margins. Now, you can look at it the other way and say that, well, they do that when the markets are hot and they're trying to cool them off, but gold has not been hot, so why raise the speculative margins? By speculative margins, I mean the margins that they charge speculators.
Okay, next question. We're going to have fun with this one. Pregnant is a total change in the President of the United States, and therefore all positions in Congress, too. Will that change the rise in value we have expected on metals, or are metals still the best security? Because no matter who does what, the dollar is going down to nearly nothing.
Well, does anybody really think that electing Mr. Boring Romney will make any difference? I mean, his policies won't be any different to Obama's, and if you think they will, then you need to go back and check what Bush's policies were and see where change brought us.
Oh, I think the tax policies will be different. I do. I think there'll be a significant difference in tax policies, but that's...
In what respect?
In terms of what gets raised, income taxes versus elimination of deductions versus capital gains tax. So I think there's a much greater chance the Republicans will protect the capital gains rate than the Democrats. So, you know, I think either way you're going to have major budget and deficit problems, but I think the Republicans are much more likely to protect investors than the Democrats.
All right, but how is that going to clean up the banks?
It's not going to make any difference at all, because the biggest problem I think we have in the economy, Franklin, is lawlessness. And so one variation of lawlessness versus the other variation of lawlessness is not going to solve the fundamental problem. Do you know what I mean?
No, but every 4 years the country goes into a trance for about 6 months thinking that it will. Well, isn't that the truth? I mean,
but here's the thing. I don't understand why anybody thinks it'll make a difference. I've started to get emails from people on, you know, sort of the Democrat or Republican side, and they're absolutely convinced that this is somehow going to be very important. Now, if you're an adult, you know, each group, the Democrats and the Republicans have each people who get the pet treats. So if you're in line to get Democratic pet treats versus you're in line to get Republican pet treats, it matters a lot to you in terms of your cash flow. But otherwise, it's complete, you know, because, you know, the tapeworm has to give pet treats to whoever plays the game. Anyway,
Well, I understand, and you understand, and I wish other people understood, it won't make any difference in terms of gross policies. And even other than at the margins of some policies, it won't make any difference which one gets elected, because they're going to carry out the same policies that have been carried out.
Right.
So what are those policies? If you look at those, I come back to my assertion, the system needs inflation like a human body needs oxygen. And they're going to inflate, and they're in desperate straits now. They're low on oxygen, and they're going to inflate. They can't figure out any other way out.
Well, I would describe it as a game of musical chairs. And let's switch to the wrap up now, because our number, Franklin and I were talking before we came on about what we think some of the key trends are, and the number, it took us a little while to decide exactly how to title this. The number one trend is the hysteria of global economics. I would describe it as a game of musical chairs, where people are competing desperately for cash flows in a highly leveraged system. You know, so the incentives to get that cash flow are off the charts, because if you don't in a highly leveraged system, you're going to have a mess. And so the competition for the cash flows is getting more and more aggressive, uglier and uglier. And the problem is the competition is getting sufficiently ugly to destroy the total pot of cash available. You know, that gets us back to the lawlessness. So you break down trust, you break down markets, you know, on and on and on. And so it, you know, the nature of the competition is destroying the very cash flow that everybody's competing for. And it reminds me of a quote I've used many times in the Salieri Report when I was in the Bush administration. One of the principal staff said to me, because the competition, the politics internally was the ugliest you've ever seen. And he said to me, "This is nuts. It's like people on a life raft going on a rubber life raft going at each other with razor blades." But that's what we're watching, and that's what the currency wars are. So I think, to me, that the last 4 months has really been marked by, not just enormous hysteria in terms of what the fundamental problems are in Spain and Greece, you know, in here and there, or, you know, is China going to stop growing? What's that going to do to America? But real hysteria in terms of people's panic that everything could go to zero tomorrow, whatever everything is.
But think about this, Catherine. That's a near-term phenomenon. That's a new phenomenon. Think about the whole risk-on, risk-off trade. If you watch markets every day the way I do, it is hysterical. It's the course of a person in hysterics, not the course of a person who has reason and vision and some kind of steadfast judgment about where he's going.
Right.
I mean, one day stocks are up. It's schizophrenic. One day stocks are manically happy and shooting up, and everybody's ebullient, and the next day they're all down in the dumps and stocks are down 200 points. Markets don't work that way. They shouldn't work that way. But that's that hysteria.
Well, and part of it is you have enormous program trading and leverage trading.
Mm-hmm.
So the float, if you look at the equity markets, the float is way, way down from the amount of institutional and retail investors versus program trading is at this point tiny, and the amount of short interest, you know, and so pumping and dumping. I was visiting with a company in Portugal, 26%, you know, they're one of the few big cap companies in Portugal, so if you want to short Portugal, they get hammered. 26% of the interest in their stock is short interest.
Ooh.
And I felt like I was talking to the mining stocks back, you know, in 2005. And, you know, it almost makes you wonder what the naked short interest is and what those games are.
Mm.
So I think the one thing I do think, and it was a wonderful interview we had with Jim Norman where he said, it's not important to be strong, it's just important to be a little bit stronger than everybody else at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a theme I've been talking about for the last couple of months called American Renaissance Fact or Fiction. Because if you look at what's happening in energy and natural gas, there's been an explosion since 2005 in domestic drilling, particularly by the small guys and the independents. And if you look at our reserves, they're exploding. And the natural gas price, somebody said to me 2 weeks ago, you know, with the price for natural gas is $15 in China, $7 in Europe, and $2 in the United States. And Norman pointed out that 40% of manufacturing costs in the United States are energy. So that's an incredible competitive advantage. And there's you're seeing a lot now to, in the American business community to promote this idea of an American renaissance, one, because of our position in agriculture, but two, because of our now, you know, incredibly growing position in domestic energy and what that could mean to manufacturing. And there, let me just add, there was a great, great 14-page special in The Economist 2 weeks ago called The Third Industrial Revolution, arguing that the latest technology in robotics and 3D printing, et cetera, could start to bring a lot of manufacturing back into the first world, which I believe is absolutely possible. So one of the things I've been telling all the subscribers is American Renaissance Fact or Fiction. And I don't know, but needless to say, the Americans right now are a little bit stronger than everybody else at the table.
Well, they always have been. but you know, I mean, there's been a move from the inside to transfer American technology and American industry overseas.
Yep.
But the position of strength that the United States has had is so overwhelming in terms of size of the economy and internal market. Most Americans don't realize it. I mean, it's astounding. But then if you look back at the history of the United States, that's what it's been built on.
Well, but here's what's interesting. The subscriber who asked the question about the election, she says no matter who does what, the dollar's going down to nearly nothing. I don't agree with that at all. I think, you know, if you look at the relative positions, there is a reasonably strong scenario, I think, that the U.S. can keep the dollar going for quite some time, particularly given what they've accomplished so far in energy in the last 5 years. Now, that's not what a lot of people want to hear, but, you know, this really, I hate to say this really comes down to a military question.
Well, okay. Okay, but working at the same time as what you're talking about and not at all against it, I really think that the system that we have is winding down, and I think
yeah.
that you see the future of it in Greece and Spain, where the presupposition has been that you can build a fat nest at government expense for yourself forever. Everybody can do it.
Right.
And clearly there's a point where that can't be done. So now what you're seeing is the real economy is beginning to emerge again. Those people who are not looking for a government handout or a sweet nest, but who are entrepreneurs and who look to make their fortune by serving other people.
Right, just like the two young people I talked to when I got the car. There were two guys I bought my car from, and all they wanted to talk about was sort of, you know, what their entrepreneurial contribution was going to be. It was quite extraordinary. I think the people who run the dollar system agree with you, which is why I think they've stockpiled gold and are using this opportunity to stockpile even more at your expense. And, you know, because their big question is, how do you get the money from here to there?
Right.
How do we take the capital out of the old model? Because the old model can't last. It, you know, it obviously can't last. And I think they know that. I think that's why they started to shift money out of North America and Europe as aggressively as they did in the 90s, you know, whether you or I like how they did it and what they did. Anyway, so second trend. So first trend, hysteria of global economics. Second one I just have to mention because, you know, I drive and travel around, is weird weather. The weather is so weird. And everywhere you go, in California, in Portugal, everywhere I've been this, you know, in the first 4 months of this year, it's just everybody's saying the weather is so strange. And I think, what, you know, if you're not a farmer, weather's not on your mind as much as it is maybe for us folks who live in rural areas, Franklin. And I think we don't appreciate how much impact weird weather has on our psychology.
Well, I think it does. We were observing today that it's about, I guess tonight it's about 50 degrees here, something like that. This is the 8th of May. It ought to be 20 degrees higher.
Right.
It's just astonishing. And yet in March, it got up to 80 degrees, which
right.
shouldn't happen either. So it is weird. And then you've got widespread drought in various areas, too. And it just doesn't seem to go together. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I was at a water symposium for a couple of days when restoring the land with water and had time to spend time with Sepp Holzer, who is arguably one of the top permaculturalists in the year. And we're going to try and do a lot more about water in the Solari Report because I think water is really coming to the fore of everybody's consciousness and the importance of sort of living in harmony with water and preserving the water and using it well on your land. Okay, next thing, I don't know if you got it, but something came around, and of course I got many copies of it. It was a story purporting to be an anonymous description of a meeting that an entertainment executive had in the 90s. Some spooky guys showed up and sort of ordered everybody to turn rap music from something very reasonably pleasant to something very gangster and criminal-oriented. The reason being, they said they were going to, you know, they were introducing all the private prison companies, which is in fact when that happened, and they needed to, you know, significantly increase arrests, so they needed to make it much more politically palatable to do that, and so having rap music and Hollywood basically promote the idea that all, you know, sort of poor black teenagers were gangsters and criminals would be very, very helpful. And so this guy, you know, intimates that this was pretty scary. When some people tried to object, they were thrown out with security guards with guns, and consequently he became discouraged and left the entertainment industry. Anyway, I never posted the story up in the blog because who knows if it's true or not. I do think the gist of it is true, and if you've ever read the Dylan Reed book that I wrote, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, which is up on the internet,
mm-hmm.
Essentially what happened in the 90s, it was very interesting, Franklin, because what happened was in the beginning of the 90s, and it started in the Clinton administration, oddly enough, a lot of the laws got put in place during the Bush administration, but the Clintons really got it going. What they were doing is they would take multi-agency teams, jurisdictional teams, including HUD, that's how I got bumped into it, and they would drop these teams into neighborhoods, so they were doing it in D.C., and they basically round up the kids. So they just drop a SWAT team in the neighborhood, 200 people, 200 enforcement agents with guns, drop in a neighborhood with helicopters, and just round up all the available kids and then put them into jail. And, of course, this was great for the prison stocks. And the Department of Justice started a company called Unicor, which would market the prison labor to the defense contractors. So if you look at, in the meantime, they shut off the appropriations to the public defender's office in D.C. So there were no lawyers to defend the kids. So the kids were basically forced to cop a plea and, you know, ended up in prison. Now, if you look at what was really happening, what we were doing is we were sending stormtroopers into communities, rounding up kids, throwing them in prison in labor camps where they provided cheap labor for the military. Okay, so if you look at what the Nazis did, and if you look at what we were doing, it was the same exact thing. The difference was a great deal of time and money had been spent in engineering the whole system to look reputable. So the kids were drug dealers, and they got convicted in a court of law where they had a jury of their peers, except they never had a jury trial because they all had to cop a plea. You know, on and on and on and on. And a great process was put in place to make this all look legitimate so everybody could think that something was happening other than just rounding up all these kids and using them as slave labor for the military. Now, the movie, the Let's Go to the Movie this week, is a movie that was made for HBO. It's called Conspiracy. And it's a film that dramatizes a 1942 conference by the Nazis. And it talks, the whole movie is on the details of how they can accelerate the shipment of the Jews into slave labor camps and to genocide them. And the amazing thing about this movie, it's the kind of movie nobody would ever want to see on a Friday or Saturday night, but the amazing thing about this movie is it gets into the need, if you're going to implement something this evil, the need to layer it up with complex process and procedures. And one of my theories is that that a lot was learned from the Nazi experience that was then used to create the drugs and the war on drugs, which would basically give you the ability to do exactly what the Nazis did in terms of slave labor, but do it on a for-profit basis. So whereas the sort of Nazi Holocaust was a very expensive thing to do, doing the same thing with the war on drugs and the narcotics trafficking is a very profitable way to essentially accomplish the same thing. But anyway, I wanted to bring that to your attention because one of the greatest frustrations I have sometimes is with the denial on this topic. And the fascinating thing for me, Franklin, was watching this entertainment executive story bounce around,
mm-hmm.
and people coming back and saying, you know, we have a real incentive problem. We've engineered an economy where people are making money on the failure of other humans. And I think this is very important because if you're going to talk about the old models failing, which I believe it is, and you believe it is,
mm-hmm.
the most important thing to me in a new model is, what are the incentives? Are the incentives we make money on helping each other succeed, or are the incentives we make money helping each other fail? And I think it's extremely important to think about that because each one of us, you know, I'm a great theory that the way we're going to create the new financial system is one person and one family at a time. Each one of us needs to look at our own lives and say, am I making money on helping other people succeed, or am I making money from helping other people fail?
Well, you know, just as a footnote to what you're saying, the entire prison system, the so-called justice system, is an enormous industry. And it's not just companies like Unicor or Corrections Corporation of America who runs private prisons, but it's the companies that furnish probation services. And if you look at the system, and people who are criminal lawyers will agree with me that the system is designed to make people fail. It
Right.
makes more money when people fail. And by the time they get through with that, they're hopeless.
Right.
And I'm not saying this is not some theoretical thing with me. You know and I know that I deal with prison inmates every week,
right.
or at least every other week, very closely and intensely. And so I know something about what they go through. They get them on probation. They jerk their chain for 6, 8, 10 years. They get them back. They revoke their probation. They go back in. And there's an enormous industry that includes prisons, prison guards, lawyers, probation officers, courts, all the employees of the courts, and it's this gigantic industry that's built on making sure that people fail and
right.
stay failed.
Right. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is it depends on a sea of government money. In 1996, if you took all federal, state, and local prisons and prisoners and added up total expenses, including capital expenses, and divided by the number of prisons, you know how much it costs per prisoner per year, according to the General Accounting Office?
No.
$154,500.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we could buy them off cheaper than that.
Right.
Why don't we give them all $150,000 and say, go out there and be good.
Right. So if you look at, you know, at the time that they did that statistics, the average American, you know, somebody making $35,000 a year and paying taxes spent their entire life paying taxes that were insufficient to pay for one prisoner for 1 year.
Right.
So this model is financed by debasing the currency.
Right.
It depends on a sea of government money. And I think one of the reasons that entertainment executive email, whether it was true or disinformation, got so much interest going is people are beginning to realize as they look around at the government budgets and people saying there's no money, they're saying, why are we spending billions and billions of dollars in this state to house people in prisons, you know, who are guilty of nonviolent crimes who could be out doing something productive? So, and that's a very good question.
Well,
okay.
By the way, one of the points is to take them out of the labor force.
Right.
Right.
Right. And to provide them for corporations for cheap.
Right.
One of the reasons I'd recommend you take a look at the conspiracy movie is, you know, sometimes when I try and explain to people the extent to which certain things are engineered proactively, it's hard to believe for most decent people that a group of people could sit around and plan these things out, but it's a perfect example of the fact that it does happen. Okay, next trend, new technology. The reports of new technology. I've done a pretty faithful job of putting up some of the new videos and some of the stories about technology. We have a science and technology section. Some of the new reports are just dazzling. There's, as I said before, there's a split in the economy. We have a new economy being born and an old one dying. The creative destruction is shocking. And part of the problem is the old economy, the leadership keeps running into Washington, begging Congress to pass more laws to protect their cash flows. I've talked a lot about the Hollywood trying to stop the Internet from the creative destruction of Hollywood's business. But expect that to accelerate. And it's very important when you do look at the stock market and the economy to realize that there's not one economy. You really have a bifurcation. Very quickly, I continue to watch, and I think the first quarter was very important. The hit on the Swiss continues with the Department of Justice proceeding criminally against the Zurich Canton Bank, that's a big gulp. Another article up this week about foreign accounts, and I think the fight over controlling foreign accounts and the fight by the Americans to maintain their leadership with the British of 50% of the financial transactions is what that is all about. And again, I expect that to get more fractious after the election. Finally, I wanted to talk about something I want to call protecting the third rail. If you look at a transit system, there are two tracks that the wheels of the trolley or the subway car run on. And then there's a third rail where the energy, the electricity runs, and the train gets its juice from the third rail. What we're watching in society is you could really see this in the first quarter of 2012. It got very intense. What you see is there's an unwritten rule that says you're not allowed to touch the third rail. Now, if you do touch the third rail, then you get slurred by some word that says that you are not safe to associate with, or you're an unacceptable person. So the slur is socialist. The slur is communist. The slur is capitalist. The slur is terrorist. The slur is conspiracy theorist. We've seen a big investment over the last 4 months in targeting people as conspiracy theorists. It's come up a lot in the debates around the documentary Thrive. But conspiracy theorist is really a euphemism for somebody who dares to touch the third rail. Now, let me tell you why this is important. In a court of law, it's essential that you're innocent until proven guilty. But in the world of managing your family and your personal risk, you need to assume that people are guilty until proven innocent. So if you look at what's going on in this world, there are millions and millions of conspiracies. As you know, I keep trying to encourage you to start your own. Be very wary of people who try and stop you from accessing the information you need to protect yourself by using any of these slurs. You need to understand where the third rail is. You need to understand who's manipulating the third world and you need the third rail, and you need to not fall into the trap of believing any of these slurs. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that, Franklin, but
well, I think what the Thrive people ran into was that they were not dealing in the standard left-right dichotomy that's used to mislead people from looking at the important things, and that's touching the third rail. Whenever you step outside that whole outline that you're supposed to look at the world in, then you're touching the third rail.
Right. When you invite people in the right and left to integrate into something that can really break through.
Yes.
That's when you take the strongest.
Right.
That's when you really get socked in the jaw.
Yeah.
A couple of other things I mentioned. The violence of the food wars got even tougher during the first quarter. We're just seeing unbelievable efforts at the federal and state level to control the food supply. It's very, very important to not let that scare you off from making sure that you find ways locally of providing a fresh food supply for you, hopefully independent of the grocery stores and the corporate chain. It's ever more important. Finally, the search for new models, I keep saying it, I'll say it again. Keep asking yourself, is it decentralizing and is it wealth building? Because it needs to be both. When I was over in Portugal, everybody kept asking me for a picture of the new model. I said, "You models, plural." We need thousands and thousands of new models. Okay, well, that's it for the wrap-up. Anything I forgot, Franklin?
No. I think you covered it all.
Okay, well, we're going to be very interested to see what happens in precious metals over the next month. I predict whatever happens, it's going to be wild. So,
well, hang on.
I know. Let's buckle our seatbelts, shall we?